Welcome, everybody, to Libertarian Ethics Lecture 2. I'm Daniel James Sanchez. You can call me Danny. And I'm going to be lecturing on Mises' ethics. In the last lecture, David Gordon gave an overview of, a lecture on overview of various forms of libertarian ethics, particularly Mises's, also Rothbard's and Hoppe's. And in this lecture, I'm going to be going more in depth into Mises's ethics in particular. First off, it's important to note that there are sort of two sides of Mises's ethics. On one side, there's a negative approach. He is defining what cannot be said concerning ethics. And that is based more on his broader philosophy. On the other side, there is the positive side, what can be said concerning ethics. And for that, he bases his understanding on praxeology. First, what can't be said about ethics. Now, this can be found especially in Theory and History, chapters 1 and 3. And actually, I'm going to assign that for week 3. It's not up there now, but I think parts of Theory and History and parts of Human Action would be great. I mean, what I try to do with my articles is distill what Mises said about ethics and explain them, but it's really good to get to the direct source. So I'm actually going to make the Hazlitt stuff that I have up there optional, because I don't want to have too much up there that's required, and the Mises stuff will be the main thing. So this is from largely from Theory and History, that he embraces what David Gordon called Hume's Law. In a couple places in Mises' corpus, he says there is no such thing as a scientific ought. So the whole is-ought divide that David Gordon talked about in the last lecture, he very much embraced that. The way he phrased Hume's Law is by making a distinction between what he calls existential propositions and value statements or value judgments. He says in Theory and History, Chapter 1, propositions asserting existence, sorry, I'm not going to do an Austrian accent for you. Propositions asserting existence, affirmative existential propositions, or non-existence, negative existential propositions, are descriptive. They assert something about the state of the whole universe or of parts of the universe. With regard to them, questions of truth and falsity are significant. They must not be confounded with judgments of value. Judgments of value are voluntaristic. They express feelings, tastes, or preferences of the individual who utters them. With regard to them, there cannot be any question of truth or falsity. They are ultimate and not subject to any proof or evidence. Now, because of this important distinction between existential propositions and value judgments, the embrace of Hume's Law, Mises believes that all sciences, not just economics, are value-free. What in German is Wertfreiheit, or Wertfreiheit. And Wertfreiheit means value-free science. So a lot of times you'll hear, even among people who subscribe to natural law ethics or argumentation ethics, you'll hear that economics is a value-free science. Every Austrian agrees about that. Mises' claim is broader. He claims that all science necessarily can only be value-free science, that science is about the is, it is not about the ought. That there is no such thing as a science of ought. Judgments of value, Mises holds, are what he calls unanalyzable givens. And that you can't impose a judgment on a judgment of value without presupposing a judgment of value from which you are judging it by. And the only judgments of value are individuals' judgments of value. So it can only be, say, the person who's speaking is judging a judgment of value based on his own judgment of value. And so he's just superimposing a judgment of value of his own. Okay? Now, the positive side of what Mises says about ethics stems from his theory of society. And much of what he says about the theory of society is also in Theory and History, but he states it in Human Action as well. What can be said about ethics is this. First of all, it's important to note that the praxeological and apodictically true law of association demonstrates that labor is more productive under the division of labor than under isolated labor whenever there are any productive inequalities. Now, what do I mean by that? Productive inequalities are any time there's any factor which makes one person different in his productivity with regard to one good than he is with regard to another good, and that other people are with regard to those goods. Whenever there's any kind of difference with those four in those four factors, the division of labor is always more physically productive. Okay? For example, whenever there is a productive inequality in the person's skills themselves. So whenever one person is just faster at gathering clay or faster at chopping wood. Another instance of this is whenever there are productive inequalities in the land or in material goods. For example, Robinson Crusoe might live on a part of the island that produces clay really abundantly, where there's a clay pit there. And so there's just really easy to access clay. Or Friday may live on a part of the island where there is abundant timber, so it's a really wooded area. Okay, so whenever there's any kind of difference that has an effect on the rate of productivity, it's more productive if the people in question specialize. It's more physically productive if they specialize in what is their comparative advantage. And one of the great things that economists have discovered, particularly the classical economists from David Ricardo and Robert Torrens and James Mill, those three people elaborated what's called the law of comparative advantage. Even before then, people realized, even skeptics of laissez-faire conceded that whenever there's an absolute advantage, for example, whenever Crusoe is better at gathering timber and Friday is better at gathering clay, that it makes sense for them to divide their labor because it's more physically productive. So it's better if instead of just working in isolation, if they just if they focus on what they're good at and then trade, that's more physically productive. Even critics of laissez-faire accepted that. But then the critics said, in cases where, for example, Crusoe is better at gathering timber and better at gathering clay, there's no advantage in the division of labor. Well, the classical economists proved that wrong. They showed that what matters is the comparative advantage. So if Crusoe's superiority to Friday in gathering timber is greater than Crusoe's superiority to Friday in gathering clay, for example, if Crusoe is 10 times faster than Friday at gathering timber, but he's only 5 times faster than Friday at gathering clay, then it's more physically productive if Crusoe focuses on gathering timber and Friday focuses on gathering clay, and then for them to trade. So the advantages of the division of labor are always present whenever there are any productive inequalities at all, even if those inequalities are such that the superiority is all on one side. The division of labor is still more physically productive. Now that's really important because productive inequalities abound. There are always productive inequalities because of what Mises calls the manifoldness of nature, that it just so happens that no two people are biologically the same. There are always some differences in terms of their ability. And no two plots, there's great diversity and great variety in land. And there's great, especially after land has been improved, there's even more variety then, and especially after people gain skills. Adam Smith talked a lot about how the division of labor reinforces itself because people become better and better at what they focus on. So especially as labor and land are improved, there's more and more manifoldness of nature. So opportunities to increase physical productivity by the division of labor abounds. Okay, it's always there. It's an empirical fact that our world is pervaded with productive inequalities. Therefore, our world is pervaded with opportunities to increase physical productivity through the division of labor. Now, that is important for Mises' theory of ethics, because the ongoing division of labor can only be effected through social cooperation. And social cooperation, in turn, can only be effected through the establishment of social bonds and social order. Therefore, all men who are aware of the productive opportunities of the division of labor have a powerful material interest to create, preserve, and intensify the social bonds and social order that make the initiation, the preservation, and the intensification of the division of labor possible. They have a material interest because it's more productive to do that. It gets you further away from the brink of starvation and a bare subsistence, and improves the quality of life. So there's a material incentive for people to preserve the social bonds and social order that make that division of labor possible. So Mises believed that this theory of the division of labor explains social evolution. It gives the scientist, the scholar, an understanding of how the progress from beasthood to savagery, from savagery to village, from village to city, and finally from city to the world-embracing market society. How that occurred, why that occurred, what was the impetus behind that? The division of labor is the fundamental social phenomenon, he said. And Mises says that the law of association is a law of cosmic becoming. He also notes that sympathy, friendship, and solidarity are effects, not causes, of social cooperation. If it was not for the greater productivity of the division of labor, people would not have had an incentive to create society, to create social bonds. It would have been a Hobbesian war of all against all, biological competition instead of social competition, where people are snatching the dwindling means of subsistence away from each other and considering each other as irreconcilable rivals. Under such a situation, sympathy, friendship, solidarity, none of those things could have developed. And as Joseph Salerno says, Mises is a social rationalist, because Mises said that social bonds and social order are the outcome of man's purposeful effort to utilize the greater productivity of the division of labor. It wasn't some social instinct. Man is a social animal because he is a rational and an acting animal. He sees the greater productivity of the division of labor, and he seeks it out through the means of social cooperation. That reveals why man is a social animal, as Aristotle said, and why man moved from beyond the state of nature. He chose the state of civilization for his end. Okay, this is characteristically Misesian in that it recognizes man for what he is, as an acting being. Okay? So again, social bonds and social order are the outcome of man's effort to utilize the greater productivity of the division of labor. Now, chief among these social bonds are moral codes, especially moral codes concerning the partitioning of scarce resources. Now, moral codes, like all human creations, are means. And they were developed and adopted to serve the same end as all other social bonds, the facilitation of social cooperation and the division of labor for the purpose of human welfare. So here's a quote from Human Action. The notion of right and wrong is a human device, a utilitarian precept designed to make social cooperation under the division of labor possible. Okay? So Mises doesn't say that the notion of right and wrong should be utilitarian. He says that it is and always has been, that the notion of right and wrong, that moral codes in the first place arise for utilitarian ends, for the purpose of making social cooperation under the division of labor possible. Okay? And by the way, I'll get to questions when I'm finished with the main lecture. I'll look at all the questions that you post in the chat now. So feel free to post. Now, property deals with the partitioning of resources. So moral codes concerning the partitioning of resources are property codes. And those are really important moral codes for the facilitation of the division of labor, because property is a really great way of facilitating the division of labor. It's the best way. And beyond a certain stage of civilization, it's the only way. Now, justice is that part of the moral code that deals with property. So, so justice is part of what Murray Rothbard in Ethics of Liberty calls political philosophy. So Murray Rothbard distinguished between moral ethics in general and the subset of ethics, which is political philosophy, which deals with what he says is the violence. So when violence is considered acceptable and when it is not. And so in particular, it deals with justice, particularly political philosophy and justice deal with property, because it tells you, okay, when you have property, and someone tries to take your property, then it's okay to resort to violence to defend that property. Now, law is the code of justice that prevails enough to actually determine property. So these are kind of the working definitions that I think we can use to understand Mises' thought. Property deals with the partitioning of resources. Justice is that part of a moral code that deals with property. And law is the code of justice, so the way people feel about justice and people's preferences and the way people think property should be arranged, that actually prevails, it goes into effect, that actually determines property. Now, codes of justice as a subset of the code of morality, and codes of law, which are codes of justice that are actually applied, Mises says that all these things, like moral codes, all these kinds of social institutions are of human origin. Like he said about right and wrong, they're human devices. They're utilitarian precepts designed to make social cooperation under the division of labor possible. They're of human origin, and the only yardstick that must be applied to them is that of expediency with regard to human welfare, because that's their function, that's why they're adopted in the first place. And he says in another part of Human Action, all moral laws and human laws are means for the realization of definite ends. There is no method available for the appreciation of their goodness or badness other than to scrutinize their usefulness for the attainment of the ends chosen and aimed at. And again, the ends chosen and aimed at are social cooperation under the division of labor for the purpose of the greater productivity of the division of labor for the purpose of secular welfare, worldly welfare. Now, it just so happens that praxeology and economics demonstrate that the property order with the greatest systemic tendency of promoting prosperity through social cooperation is what I call the private property order of liberalism. Now that's important because people adopt moral codes, particularly codes of justice and law, for the purpose of prosperity. And the code of justice and law that is best at promoting prosperity is the private property order of liberalism. And we know that because of praxeological analysis, because of economic analysis. Now, what is the private property order of liberalism? It involves permanent self-ownership, so it excludes slavery, and the perpetual, even distant, ownership of rivalrous goods that one has homesteaded or contracted for, as well as all rivalrous products of those goods. Okay? So it all starts with homesteading, that the first appropriator of land, of an unused, uncontrolled resource, that person gains perpetual ownership of that, and even distant ownership. So even if you stray away from it, or if you lend it to someone to work on it, it's still yours. As well as all the products of that, and limited to rivalrous goods. So the air and ideas. Praxeology and economics demonstrate that that this is the best private property order, that this facilitates the division of labor and the greater productivity of the division of labor better than any other private property order. And the article that I assigned of mine that's called Choose Company, the Basics of Property, that was actually just posted today as a Mises Daily. I gave you the link to it on my blog, but here is the link to where it is on the Mises Daily, and I go over the reasons why that's the ideal, the most productive, the highest utility private property order. And someone who gives a beautifully distilled explanation of why that is someone that you don't usually think of associated with utilitarian arguments for liberalism, is Hoppe, because Hoppe he says that the he also gives utilitarian arguments. I don't know if he called them utilitarian arguments, but he he distinguishes between the goal of political philosophy and the goal of political economy. And so political philosophy, he says, is for just property. It is for make society as just as possible. And the goal of political economy is to find out how to make society as productive as possible, as to maximize human welfare. But he doesn't see Mises kind of resolves the one into the other, whereas Hoppe and Rothbard keep those two things distinct. It's just kind of a coincidence that they both happen to come together in the same private property order. Hoppe gives a great distillation of why that particular order is the best in terms of political economy. He says, any deviation from this set of rules implies, by definition, a redistribution of property titles and hence of income away from user producers and contractors of goods and onto non-user producers and non-contractors. As a consequence, any such deviation implies that there will be relatively less original appropriation of resources whose scarcity is realized. There will be less production of new goods, less maintenance of existing goods, and less mutually beneficial contracting and trading. This naturally implies a lower standard of living in terms of exchangeable goods and services. Further, the provision that only the first user, not a later one, of a good acquires ownership assures that productive efforts will be as high as possible at all times. So that is Hoppe from The Economics and Ethics of Private Property, which is his treatise. So it's important to distinguish that between the ethics and economics of private property, which is a paper. The one that has economics first, that's a book, and the one that has ethics first, that's his paper that was assigned to you by Dr. Golden. Now, the power of public opinion. Mises says that all social order is determined by ideology. Now, he defines ideology as a worldview concerning human conduct and cooperation. Okay, so a worldview is the totality of theorems and theories about the way things work. And so ideology is the totality of theories and theorems about the way human affairs work. Law and the prevailing code of justice are always determined by the prevailing ideology. So if people have a different understanding of the way human society and human conduct and cooperation about the way they work, that will be reflected in the prevailing codes of law and justice. And so some people might object that, well, you know, only in a democracy or something like that, and not maybe that wouldn't occur if or maybe that doesn't occur even in a democracy, because in any case maybe the power elite decide. But Mises, following Etienne de Boitie and David Hume, and also Rothbard and Hoppe both agree with this, believes that it is ideological might that decides these issues, that the people in power that they only remain in power because they have the tacit support of the majority. That he says there's no such thing as a long-lived tyranny, because if people don't think that the given social order is in their interest, if there's a widespread belief in that, then they will overthrow it, because that's where the strength is in the majority, and they only acquiesce to a given social order and a given and people being in certain positions of power because they think that that's because their ideology tells them that that's the way that that their interests will be served best. Okay. Now, with regard to legal order, particularly questions of law and justice and property, people are ultimately primarily concerned with living standards. Okay? So he says that when it comes to law and justice, there's a concrete understanding of happiness that's important, and that's living standards. That people don't really expect, like, you know, spiritual fulfillment from the given property order. They want food and clothes and nice houses and health and healthcare and all those kinds of things, secular satisfaction, utility. Now, if the public is convinced that complete adherence to any given social order, so if they're convinced that complete adherence to private property, with no exception, private property, best, if they think that best facilitates social cooperation in its function of advancing human welfare, this revolution in public opinion, if that becomes the ideology, the prevailing ideology, because he says that all social orders are determined by ideology. He says that in a direct quote. This revolution in public opinion will necessarily affect a revolution in the prevailing codes of justice and law and in the actual property order. So here's a quote from Mises. Because man is a social animal that can thrive only within society, all ideologies are forced to acknowledge the preeminent importance of social cooperation. They must aim at the most satisfactory organization of society and must approve of man's concern for improvement of his material well-being. Thus, they all place themselves upon a common ground. They are separated by problems of means and ways, so not by ultimate problems of ends. Such ideological antagonisms are open to a thorough scrutiny by the scientific methods of praxeology and economics. Since it's a matter of means and not ends, you don't need a value-laden science, a science of ought. To effect change, you only need praxeology and economics, because those are sciences of means. They show how best to facilitate social cooperation and the division of labor, which are the ends of all moral codes in the first place. And Mises says that the fact that ideologies are forced to acknowledge the preeminent importance of social cooperation, and they must aim at the most satisfactory organization of society and must prove man's concern for an improvement of material well-being. That is why you find in real political life, in actual political life, that all political parties, monarchists, communists, laissez-faire, even religiously associated parties, Democrats, everybody, that what they promise their constituents, their auditors, a higher standard of living. They may adorn their pronouncements with metaphysical claims and other claims about ultimate unanalyzable ends, but they always promise a higher standard of living. They never ask their constituents to sacrifice their standard of living unless it's for the sake of a later improvement in their standard of living. Okay, and now I'd like to read a quote from my article, The Harmony, the Profound Significance of Social Harmony, which goes further into the utilitarian superiority of capitalism. That for the reasons Papa says, the private property order of liberalism, even before capitalism can develop, even before you have economic calculation or any kind of a division of labor across time, even before you reach that point, there's always a utilitarian superiority of liberalism. But you particularly see it when liberalism when something becomes a flower, when something buds into a flower, flourishes into capitalism. So what I say is blooms into capitalism. The singular tendency of capitalism is to provide for individuals the satisfaction of their wants according to the extent of their contribution to the satisfaction of the wants of others. Through the market process, the consumer tends to reward each producer according to his contribution to consumer satisfaction. Capitalism therefore encourages individuals to, in their own interest, ever adjust their choices of roles and actions so as to ever increase their contribution to the satisfaction of human wants. The relative importance of some consumers' wants are greater than that of others in this process, but the relative importance of any given consumer's wants, insofar as that relative importance has been determined on the market, is a function of how much he contributed to the satisfying of the wants of other consumers in his role as producer. Thus, under capitalism, human choices, through their interplay, coordinate each other so as to provide for human welfare as bountifully as possible. Every state intervention into the market nexus, every tax, regulation, redistribution, or expansion of bureaucracy only slackens the ties linking contribution and income, thereby hampering the instrumentality of the market by making producers less responsive to consumers and thus leading to a reduction in consumer satisfaction. And because, with regard to economic provision, we are all consumers first and foremost, and producers only subordinately, reduced consumer satisfaction means reduced public welfare. Here's a question that I pose in one of the assigned readings of my article, Why Liberalism? That would be, I'd be interested to hear the students' answers to, particularly students who adhere to absolutist type. I mean, Rothbard and Hoppe, it's not, that's not a smear term. I mean, Rothbard and Hoppe call their types of ethics absolutist ethics. Oh, that's great to hear, Charles. This post converted me towards the Mises-ian position. Oh, that's great. If you were convinced that A, complete adherence to the natural right of property necessarily engenders untold poverty, suffering, and death, but B, the tiniest imaginable abrogation of the non-aggression principle would necessarily engender prosperity, happiness, and long life for virtually everybody, which would you choose, complete adherence or the tiny abrogation? And this is similar to a question that Henry Hazlitt poses in The Foundations of Morality, where he talks about the question of let justice be done though the world be destroyed. So the answer of that question kind of gets at, like, okay, is justice resolved into utility, or is utility resolved into justice? Are they separate? If they are separate, you know, which has preference? Okay. Value-free utilitarianism and the parachuting ethicist fallacy. So this is a quote from the last part of my in defense of Misesian utilitarianism, or Mises' utilitarianism. Utilitarian liberalism does not say, quote, you want B, but you should really want A. Rather, it says, quote, you think B will result in Y, which you want, but it will not. Instead, it will result in X, which you do not want. However, if you adopt A, you will get Z, which you would like best, but did not even know was possible. So that's the value-free part. And that's where the utilitarian ultimately is speaking to a man's purposes, not imposing ends on him, ultimate ends on him, and also not solely speaking to his reason, speaking to his purposes. Furthermore, and it says this not with regard to particular choices considered in isolation, but with regard to the systemic consequences to be expected of general rules. So this is the distinction between rule utilitarianism and act utilitarianism. So, for example, the Chicago School utilitarians, they can tend to be act utilitarianism. So Hoppe, in his Ethics and Economics of Private Property, the essay that Dr. Gordon assigned, he talks about how the Chicago School utilitarians, they think that courts should decide property rights based on the wealth maximization of a particular instance. So that's act utilitarianism. But the rule utilitarian says that when you do that and you treat private property as less than sacrosanct, as just something that you can just manipulate at will, that the systemic that hurts everybody's interest in the long run, that that even if you could do interpersonal utility comparisons, and which you can't, even if you could say that that in that one case you've maximized wealth, that that by violating the rule of private property, that you end up doing a lot more harm than good. And in the next set of readings, I think it's chapter 6 of Henry Hazlitt's Foundations of Morality, It's all about the need for general rules, and talks about rural utilitarianism. And what's interesting to me is how clearly David Hume set out rural utilitarianism, even though contemporary rural utilitarians don't even realize that he was so pioneering, that he had it pretty much figured out, you know, back in the 18th century. They think that is a wholly modern doctrine. Hazlitt points that out. Okay, furthermore, it says this not in order to persuade each individual in every concrete choice in their daily lives, but so as to effect a revolution in public opinion concerning social expediency, which in turn, and so that revolution in public opinion concerning social expediency, that's the ideology that Mises writes about. That ideology always determines social order, which in turn will necessarily engender a revolution in the prevailing moral code and the prevailing legal and property code. So contrary to that is the parachuting ethicist idea of utilitarianism, where everyone does sort of like utilitarian, or a utilitarian parachutes into the room and you know, does an astounding feat of utilitarian reasoning, telling them why it's against their long run interest to, you know, lobby for a subsidy or to seek feather bedding or to do any kind of rent seeking type thing. That's not the way it works. That's not what we're talking about. Like Mises says, it's a matter of public opinion. So in my Misesian ethics, defense of Mises' utilitarianism, I give the example of the person who's lobbying for a special interest. He says that it's not up to the, you know, just the man on the spot to do some sort of utilitarian philosophy and realize that this you know, this is against his long-run interest and the long-run interest of society. It's a matter of public opinion. It's a matter of the prevailing ideology. And that ideology actuates itself in conscience and approbation and reprobation and punishment and reward, so that the person on the spot is motivated by those factors. The prevailing social, the prevailing moral code, the ideology is against the general practice of feather bedding or the general practice of subsidies. Then all those factors come into play. That the primary reason that the man on the spot doesn't engage in those activities is that he just feels bad about it. He just feels guilty, and that people just frown upon him and call him names when he does it, and that he might go to jail even. So that's what I call the alternative to the parachuting ethicist fallacy. Here are some interesting quotes in case you're curious about what Mises wrote about natural law. I'm not sure. David can confirm whether or not this is true. I don't think Mises reviewed Ethics of Liberty. Was he even alive? I'm not even sure if he was alive when Rothbard wrote Ethics of Liberty or published Ethics of Liberty. I don't think he responded at length to Rothbard's doctrines in particular. He did, like I mentioned in the discussion forum, he did say that he has differences with Rothbard regarding his philosophy of jurisprudence. But he does make several remarks about natural law in general. And of course, the historical tradition of natural law that Rothbard you know, Rothbard's position is an evolution of that. So not everything that Mises said about natural law necessarily applies to what Rothbard said. But this is his take on natural law. From the notion of natural law, some people deduce the justice of the institution of private property in the means of production. Other people resort to natural law for the justification of the abolition of private property in the means of production. As the idea of natural law is quite arbitrary, such discussions are not open to settlement. And in the next quote, he actually, interestingly, portrays natural law as sort of a preliminary stage to economics and utilitarianism. Long before the classical economists discovered that irregularity in the sequence of phenomena prevails in the field of human action, the champions of natural law were dimly aware of this inescapable fact. From the bewildering diversity of doctrines presented under the rubric of natural law, there finally emerged a set of theorems which no cavilling can ever invalidate. Now he's talking about economics, the regularity of human affairs that economics reveals in praxeology. There is first the idea that a nature-given order of things exists to which man must adjust his actions if he wants to succeed. So for example, in other places he talks about how democratic majorities and monarchs and the state in general, it only begrudgingly accepts laws of nature, laws of physics, and so it really doesn't like the fact that its activities are bound by the laws of human action. I think Napoleon particularly had some quotes where he says he recognizes no such laws, and I think that's why he called J.B. Say and his school of economists ideologues, that he had little regard for that, and particularly in Germany in the 19th century, there was kind of this disregard for human for laws of human action, and that expressed itself through what Menger called the Prussian police science. So, second, the only means available to man for the cognizance of this order is thinking and reasoning, and no existing social institution is exempt from being examined and appraised by discursive reasoning. So Mises shares with Rothbard in his critique of legal positivists. Some legal positivists will say that there are no, there's no standard by which you can judge the law outside of the law itself. Rothbard says that you can judge it by, you know, natural law, against natural law. Mises says natural law theory is right in that you can judge it, but the only yardstick, and this is the third point, that there is no standard available for appraising any mode of acting, either of individuals or of groups of individuals, but that of the effects produced by such action. So the only yardstick that you can judge human laws by is human welfare. Carried to its ultimate logical consequences, the idea of natural law led eventually to rationalism and utilitarianism. Now, here are some thoughts raised by Dr. Gordon's lecture. At the beginning, Dr. Gordon mentioned about how in this course we're going to be talking about ways you can justify libertarianism. So, and he said that libertarianism defined as the absence of a state, or where the state only limits itself to the protection of property, of life and limb and property. And so under that, you have anarcho-capitalism on one side and minarchism, or you might call it minarcho-capitalism, on the other side. Now, Mises was what you might call a minarchist or a minarcho-capitalist. And he was utilitarian, but that does not mean that utilitarianism must lead to minarchism. That I believe that utilitarianism, with a full understanding of praxeology and economics, that and the full understanding that has developed even beyond Mises. There's been a lot of great anarcho-capitalist economic work that shows not just the absolutist moral superiority of anarcho-capitalism, but the utilitarian superiority of anarcho-capitalism. And it started even before Mises. Gustav de Molinari was something of a utilitarian anarcho-capitalist. He definitely was an anarcho-capitalist, and he didn't give esoteric philosophical reasons for it. He gave economic arguments for it, and that this was in the 19th century. Some other Hazlitt and Mises, there are some differences between Hazlitt and Mises. For example, while Hazlitt wasn't a legal positivist, he was kind of more in the common law tradition than Mises was. He criticized Rothbard for being an extreme a priorist, for not adopting the common law position. But actually, Mises would also be an extreme a priorist, but from the utilitarian point of view, that he and also from the social rationalist point of view, that he believed that praxeology and economics can demonstrate in an a priori sense what is the best legal order for human welfare, and that you don't need to kind of stumble upon the answer through the evolution of common law. What else? Popper and Hume's law. So you might assume that Popper is with Rothbard in rejecting Hume's law, but he actually didn't. Popper actually accepts Hume's law, and I think this is an interesting note. He claims his ethical theory is wertfrei, is value-free. So in the Economics and Ethics of Private Property, Hoppe writes, there is the logical gap between is and ought statements, which natural rights proponents have failed to bridge successfully. Okay, so Hoppe is actually on Mises' side in this question. And to continue the quote, except for advancing some general critical remarks regarding the ultimate validity of the fact value dichotomy. Here, the praxeological proof of libertarianism has the advantage of offering a completely value-free justification of private property. It remains entirely in the realm of is statement, It never tries to derive an ought from an is. The structure, and then he goes through the structure of the argument and why it's all about the is. And then he goes on, the proof also offers a key to an understanding of the nature of the fact-value dichotomy. Ought statements cannot be derived from is statements. They belong to different logical realms. Okay. And since I've already gone an hour and 7 minutes, I've gone a bit over time, I'm going to stop there. Maybe I'll pick up on my other slides in the next lecture, or if there's time after people we're done with questions, I can return to my slides. So I'm going to go and look at the questions you have posted. Okay, David Gordon says the position in Mises, if people could just take a break from posting for a second so I can get a bead on the scrolling of the chat, that'd be great. The position in Mises' quotation goes beyond Hume's law. Mises says judgments of value are voluntaristic. Hume's law just says that value judgments don't follow from purely descriptive claims. This leaves open whether they have a truth value. Okay, that's a good point. Charles Devan asks, is the word designed significant? Well, yes. There's design, and then there's the design of what Hayek called taxis versus the design of what Hayek called cosmos. And Mises stresses that people don't act for the purpose of creating society. They don't, like an individual doesn't have the goal in mind, oh, I want to create society, so I'm going to act in this way. Mises, even though Mises is a social rationalist, to an extent, as Salerno points out, to an extent he does accept Adam Ferguson's, this is a Scottish Enlightenment thinker, Adam Ferguson's distinction between products of human action versus products of human design. That an individual doesn't say, "Oh, I'm going to do this because it's going to result in this moral code and this society, and everybody's going to be better off." It doesn't happen in that way. But it is there. It's still every step of it is incrementally working towards in that direction, and each increment of that is purposeful, and so the people work towards a society in which the division of labor is possible, and the greater productivity of the division of labor is possible, and the ultimate ends of that are always human welfare. Okay. So Nahu says, can we really evaluate tininess if someone else is being harmed? Only we can judge tiny and large, so if we accept the tiny infraction, it would be voluntary. And Matthew follows up with that. Good point. Good point. Sorry, I lost the scroll. Wouldn't that involve an interpersonal comparison of utility. Okay, now we have to be careful not to. And you can post. You can post now. This would be a good time to post since I'm not reading. I'm just talking now. We have to be careful to not go too far with the statement that there's no such thing as an interpersonal comparison of utility measurement. Okay? Because, I mean, you could take that to the extent that, oh, well, then you can say that there's no difference between, like, the prosperity of North Korea and the prosperity of South Korea, because there's no such thing as interpersonal utility measurement. I mean, obviously, that's ridiculous. That people, and it's not a scientific measurement, it's not a quantitative measurement, but there is a real sense in which people can understand and people can choose between different outcomes of society, and so there is, people can't compare quantitatively two different sets of alternative prosperities, but people can compare them, even if it's not the quantitative comparison. People can compare them, and one can be obviously superior to another. So then that just gets back to the question. What would you choose if it was just a tiny abrogation of natural property rights, of the liberal property order? And I'm not saying that is the case, but I'm just saying, like, everybody has the experience of, like, you understand a certain thing about philosophy before you understand a certain thing about economics. So you can put yourself in the state of mind, okay, you haven't studied economics yet that much, but you have studied Rothbardian natural law philosophy, and you follow the chain of reasoning of Rothbardian natural law philosophy, and you come to accept the conclusion, okay, yeah, it's unnatural for man to aggress against someone's property. So that's that. That's justice. And so that's what we should want, right? But then you can, even though if you studied economics, you know that that you don't need to sacrifice that sense of justice for the sake of human prosperity, because actually if you pursue that form of justice, that there would be the greatest human prosperity. But you haven't but what if you, economics proved to you that actually you do need a tiny abrogation of the natural right to human prosperity? Otherwise, you'll get, like, the destitution of North Korea. Which would you choose? Honestly, which would you choose? And that gets at what is really motivating us. I mean, I think deep down inside, a lot of libertarians are constitutional utilitarians, even if they don't, you know, espouse it vocally. But that sort of subconsciously we want to grasp any kind of argument that, especially that if it can make it more ironclad and, like, cover instances where, like, if even cover, like, sadists who want people to suffer and stuff, like, oh, we can even catch them and prove that they're wrong too, and that you want it as ironclad and complete and full argument as possible to make the case for liberty. But really, deep down inside, which would you choose? if it came down to a choice. Okay, David Gordon says, Well, Charles says, is this not a false choice? Yes, in actuality, it is a false choice. But I'm trying to get at what would you choose? And so, like I said, that even though now that you have studied like the philosophy of Rothbardian justice and economics, that you know that it's a false choice, put yourself in the position where you don't know it's a false choice. Put yourself in the position where maybe you have a misunderstanding of economics, but that's your honest understanding of economics. And you have this Rothbardian understanding of justice. But what would you choose then? Okay. Okay, so Dr. Gordon says, suppose you answer that you would choose A. It does not follow that you support your support for the non-aggression principle must really be based on utility. So if you chose A, now which one was A? Was that the utility, or was that the prosperity, or the complete? Let me go back. I forget which one was which. A is complete adherence. So if you choose A, right, yeah, so if you choose A, then obviously you are of the position of let justice be done though the world be destroyed. And that's fine. I mean that's your value judgment, but I'm just saying that with Mises, I say that most people are not like that. That most people, when it comes to the legal property justice order of society, that mostly they're concerned with human welfare, with secular human welfare. Okay, next. Okay, Charles Devon says, a question for both Danny and Professor Gordon. How do you respond to the ascetic? Well, the way Mises responds to the ascetic is, first of all, that he says that it's hard to name more than a handful of ascetics who in history have followed their doctrine to its logical conclusion, that all ascetics do. I mean, most quote-unquote ascetics do accept the, they do want to eat. They, like Wicksteed said, Philip Wicksteed said, that you can't be a lover or a saint unless you have recently had something to eat. And so they don't take their, so to the extent that they do that, especially, this society wouldn't be able to support people with that lifestyle unless it had an advanced division of labor. And this people wouldn't, a huge percentage of people without the division of labor, a huge percentage of people who are alive now would be dead, including a lot of the ascetics. But ultimately, the biggest factor that's important is the fact that there just aren't that many of ascetics at all. Even if you kind of broaden your definition of what true asceticism is to include some people who do eat once in a while, even if you do that, then they're just not practically important in terms of the prevailing ideology, in terms of what legal and justice order actually happens. So, and this gets at another fallacy, is that people often deride utilitarianism because they point to some exceptions, and they think that the utilitarian argument has to convince everybody, and it doesn't. It doesn't. It's not like, oh, well, we don't have unanimous consensus, so, you know, so we're not going to have this social order. What matters is what the vast majority of people want and aim for and strive for. Also, Mises makes the important point that for not for aesthetics, but just sort of like spiritual people, that they, and this goes at the Wicksteed quote too, that it's a lot easier to, you know, seek spiritual aims if your underlying material aims that upon which the spiritual aims depend on having satisfied first, if those are satisfied. And he points out that like some of the greatest spiritual accomplishments, the greatest art, the greatest music, that those happen when there's during the age of liberalism, during the 19th century. Okay, next. Matthew responds to the aesthetic question, if the aesthetic values aestheticism as its ultimate end or as a means to a further ultimate end, to what does one need to respond? Charles says they do not care about human flourishing or prosperity in any sense as defined by liberals, presumably. Jeffrey Ludwig says, I don't think it matters, though the private property code engendered by the majority of people's preferences for material well-being leaves the aesthetic free to pursue his own ends. Excellent point. The aesthetic, if he wanted to impose an aesthetic set of morals on everybody else, would be barred from doing it by the preponderance of individuals who value material well-being, who have affected private property code. Exactly. The only way is that the aesthetic's aims would be really contrary to the liberal order is if he was kind of an aggressive aesthetic, that like the needs of his aestheticism are such that he has to impose it on other people, or he has to impose poverty on other people in order for him to feel, you know, in touch with God or something like that, then obviously that's not compatible with a liberal society. But that's even a tinier subset of aesthetics than the subset we've already been talking about. Matthew says, I don't think they necessarily don't care about human flourishing or prosperity. They just see things, different things as meeting those ends. Neither Mises nor the deontologists claim that there are no actors who do not seek different ends. They just claim that they're necessarily minority. So Nahu then says, okay, maybe Danny is telling us to construct a value scale of tiny and large and fractions and answer the questions. And I already talked about, you know, quantitative comparisons versus just direct comparisons. Thank you, Matthew. Mises was not alive for the Ethics of Liberty because it was 1982, and he died in 70. And yeah, David confirms that. Based on how terrible things can get when private property is abolished, cannibalism, anyone? This is Nahu. I think even the aesthetic should favor some kind of private property rights. He just needs to, one, believe that the abolition... Okay, yeah, so I think we've got the aestheticism question covered pretty well. Okay, Leslie brings in another issue about the tiny abrogations question. Tiny abrogations, such as the modest introduction of the income tax in 1914, tiny abrogations tend to become institutionalized and expanded. Well, yes, and that's a, you know, consequentialist point. I think the utilitarian has to justify an abrogation as an institutionalized practice, justification on a rule utilitarian basis, basis, that's a good point, rather than as an isolated violation of rights, justification on an act to obtain. Excellent point. Nahu says that he has another point coming down the chat. Okay. I hope we covered that. Okay. Right. Charles Devon says, indeed, I thought Danny's example was meant to reinforce Hazlitt's point against the maxim, let justice be done though the heavens may fall. That's the actual quote I was saying, though the world be destroyed. Although I think they both, they have Latin versions of both. Hazlitt and Danny's contention is that this misses the point of justice in the first place. Yes, exactly. Jeffrey Ludwig says that leaves open the possibility for people to choose moral codes that don't work towards their own interests, or substituting a more satisfactory for a less satisfactory state of affairs, but that doesn't invalidate the analysis of how moral codes arise in society. Nahu says, I think it may be okay to perform the infraction, maybe, however, I think by advocating the infraction, I need to make some kind of compensation, maybe I should just pick infraction. Unless the good things are awesome enough to make this compensation possible. Okay, so that kind of goes into specifics. Okay, Nahu says, I think Roderick Long has an example where if you are stuck in a snowstorm and find a cabin where the owner is not home, it may be okay to break in. He is not around for us to ask his permission. It is still bad, though, so we must not do extra damage, and we incur an obligation to pay him back. And again, this is these kind of lifeboat scenarios are basically conditions of scarcity, such that no matter what we say about moral codes, people revert to biological conditions. So everyone has to just kind of ask themselves what they would do in such a situation. But these sort of, monstrous situations, that's not what moral codes are developed for in the first place. Like, the people don't develop moral codes so that, in lifeboats, the best outcome occurs, or in snowstorms where the only way that you could survive is to break into a cabin. I mean, these very particular sort of things that's not what the ongoing division of labor and social cooperation is about. Okay, so again, I think this gets at the this also gets at the parachuting ethicist fallacy, that people have this idea that, we need to devise some sort of code where we can just, like, in any given situation, look up in the quote code or perform some sort of ratiocination that will, like, spit out the right outcome. I think that really misses the point. Oh, David actually meant choose B. Oh, okay. Okay, so B is the abrogation of the non-aggression principle. And he says that doesn't necessarily, so Dr. Gordon says it doesn't necessarily mean that you choose it for utilitarian purposes. Personally, I think that it would be a good indication. I don't know if it logically follows. Like necessarily logically follows, but I think it's a good indication, and I think it's telling, and I think it's worthwhile for the person to do for themselves. I don't mean this question to be sort of a logical proof. I mean for it to be a way of getting at for in yourself what really motivates you as a libertarian. An indication of what motivates you. Charles says there aren't that many libertarians as compared to statists. Could statists so easily dismiss? Okay, so the aesthetics issue again. Okay, Dr. Gordon says, here is an example to illustrate the problem with the argument for utilitarianism based on the choice of D over A. Suppose that you think it is morally wrong to eat meat. If your life depended on eating meat, though, you would do it. It doesn't follow that your actual reason for avoiding meat is that this benefits your health. Okay, so yeah, like I said, it's not a logical proof, but there are some situations where you can, that there are some alternative reasons for it that could possibly explain it, explain that choice, other than what I'm proposing. But like I said, it's a good indication. If one makes a false hypothesis, one can prove anything he wants, and so an anti-liberal can make any false assumption he wants to prove his point. Okay. And Justin says, good lecture, Danny. Do you give speeches often? Thank you, Justin. I don't, actually. This is the first lecture that I helped out Bob Murphy for some of his office hours for his Principles of Economics class a while ago. But that was the last time I've given anything like this. So this is fun for me. I don't get this chance often. So thank you guys so much for attending and for posting such great questions. Thank you, Dr. Gordon. Oh, wow. That's great to hear from you. So, if you have any questions or other comments, feel free to post in the discussion forum in the Academy page for the course. And I will also update the syllabus so that there will be links to, I'm going to assign Theory of History Chapter 3 is a really good chapter to read, and the chapters are the parts of the Human Society chapter in Human Action, covering the division of labor, the law of association, and the role of ideas in particular, because I think that's important for understanding Mises's, not only Mises's utilitarian doctrine, but his strategy of liberty. I mean, this really all gets at why, at Mises's life mission, that because he believed that that the majority ideology concerning means and concerning human prosperity is what determines the actual legal and justice and property order, that's why he was such a passionate educator of economics, is that if he could just convince thought leaders of this, of true economics, that, you know, that those thought leaders would in turn convince what Hayek called the second-hand dealers in knowledge, and they would in turn convince the people and the populace in large at large. And when I say convince, I don't mean that they can actually, you know, teach an economics class themselves. I'm not saying that all of humanity has to be economists for you know, liberalism to take effect. What the way it works is that maybe not even the secondhand dealers of information, not even they completely understand all of the economic theorems, but they understand the theorists the top level theorists enough, and are the theorists have made a strong enough case that they believe that those theorists do have an understanding, and that the private property order is the best order, and so then they convince the populace in general. And the populace in general has even less of an understanding, as do the second-hand dealers of information, the journalists and the teachers and men. But it's enough. And so, for example, Mises understood all of this, all of the economics. Ron Paul read Mises. Ron Paul doesn't understand all of economics, but he understood Mises enough, and the basic points enough, and that he believed that Mises did have a full understanding. So then Ron Paul uses his level of understanding to then convince millions of listeners and himself. And then all these new libertarians, they also don't have a complete understanding of economics, but they think Ron Paul does, and whoever Ron Paul's in the meeting do. And so then they become libertarians, and that's how the ideologies change. And so that's why Mises was so passionate as an economics educator, because he really believed that it could change the world. Okay, and with that, I will sign off. Thank you again so much, everybody, and I will see you at Dr. Gordon's lecture, for the third lecture of this course, a week from today. Take care.